for those with neurological-related sensitivities, symptoms and conditions such as anxiety, tremors, tingles, numbness, brain fog, aches and pains, insomnia and restless legs, to name just a few. Many people in these situations, as well as those with weak stomachs, acid reflux, pancreas issues, gallbladder problems, and digestive compromise and distress such as Crohn's, IBS and colitis, have figured out that they feel best steering clear of coffee. People without these issues should be able to find enjoyment in coffee because their stomachs can take the hit as their first line of defense. Coffee going to the stomach should be its only path. There's a controlled environment there with built-in protective measures to safeguard you. When substances enter the stomach, alarm bells ring to prepare the pancreas, liver, and intestinal tract. Regardless of whether it's a can of soda, a glass of milk, a parasite picked up from eating out at a restaurant, or a cup of coffee, dispersal is delegated properly so that by the time it enters the bloodstream, it's already partially diffused. It's part of the stomach's miraculous ability to balance and make neutral whatever enters it. Like a submarine deep down in the ocean of your body, its prime objective is to keep its systems untampered with. Everything must remain calm, cool, collected and organized, or calamity will ensue. When it comes to any foods, liquids or fluids of any kind, medicines, parasites or bacteria, whether good or bad, entering the intestinal tract through the rectum, however, the stomach's safeguard does not apply. When it's something gentle and mild entering this environment, it doesn't pose a threat. With a substance as strong as coffee, it's another story. Coffee's acidic nature and nervous system assaulting effect is way too intense for the colon to handle on its own. And when anything harsh or toxic comes in this way, when it doesn't go through the checkpoints that entering through the stomach provides, regardless of what it is, the liver becomes very vulnerable. For the liver, the stomach is like that friend who always has its back. The stomach knows that the liver is working for its needs too, so it's a family-like relationship of mutual benefit. The liver is not made to handle a direct threat or hit. When one comes, it will instantly prompt the adrenals to release adrenaline as a defense mechanism, even though the liver despises excess adrenaline, since it needs to sponge it up to protect you. Still, in this situation, it employs adrenaline as an army of soldiers to do battle, armed with guns and knives. Coffee enemas trigger these adrenaline surges. The adrenaline, ordered by the general, the liver, is to warn the heart there may be trouble. This may sound extreme. A coffee enema seems so harmless. Logically, it doesn't seem like a threat. It seems like a safe protocol. When considered next to so many of the conventional protocols in medicine that are really, truly dangerous and unsafe, a coffee enema does pale in comparison. That's our assessment with our minds, though. Here, the liver calls the shots, and the liver sees the coffee enema as trouble. There's a second adrenaline rush involved, and that's from the caffeine of the coffee itself. When coffee bypasses the usual stomach, duodenum, small intestine route, which would have delegated the caffeine properly and appropriately in the most delicate way possible, so that it would be diffused when it entered the bloodstream and in this way protect your heart from being assaulted by caffeine, and instead enters the intestinal tract through the rectum, the adrenals are triggered for another reason. That's because the caffeine itself is rogue. It finds its way into the bloodstream immediately, with no hydrochloric acid or other components of gastric juices or bile to slow it down. This is something about which people with sensitive nervous systems and adrenal issues need to be aware. These are people who have trouble with caffeine to begin with. I'm sure there are people with high anxiety who don't know coffee makes it worse. So they're frequently in line at the coffee shop, ordering their favourite brew, meanwhile controlling their anxiety with anti-anxiety medication. There are also many who do know coffee puts them on edge. For people in both of these groups, when coffee is applied through an enema, it can really trigger or heighten a symptom like anxiety. Often, practitioners, loving, caring professionals who aren't at fault for the mistake, are taught to say that experiences like these are detox symptoms. The truth is that the adrenaline and caffeine of a coffee enema can be too much on the body because the digestive system is practically our second central nervous system. For those who are still wondering, putting everything else aside, does the liver really cleanse with a coffee enema? The answer is that while a coffee enema may force a little purging of the liver, a boomerang effect also occurs. Poisons that are leaving the liver instead of being flushed out of the body inevitably end up rerouted back to the liver because they're not being cleansed in a safe way. The liver sends chemical compounds into the bloodstream to try to round up and corral as many escaped toxins as possible to protect the brain and heart. The adrenaline that the liver calls out for and that the caffeine triggers quickly circulates and is sponged up by the liver too. That is, the liver can end up more toxic from a coffee enema than when it started. The liver does not like to be forced to cleanse. So when coffee enters the colon directly, the liver may nearly shut down, going on momentary low battery to prepare itself for enhanced functioning within a few seconds or minutes, when it will need to go into high gear to deal with the onslaught of adrenaline and poisons. An enema can be extremely detoxing for the liver when instead of coffee, the enema solution is a little lemon freshly squeezed into pure distilled or reverse osmosis, RO, water. Distilled and RO water don't offer minerals when you drink them. In an enema, though, they drive out impurities and the fresh lemon juice makes the water more effective. This type of enema is more effective than a coffee enema because it doesn't make the liver scream out for the release of adrenaline. And caffeine isn't present to release more adrenaline. If you're not a fan of enemas, you don't need to do one at all. Beets. The concept that beets are what the liver needs has been swimming out there for a long time. They're considered a liver-healing, blood-building food. Are beets really good for us? Yes, they're a powerful food indeed, and they do help the liver cleanse and heal a little bit. If they're organic and guaranteed to be non-GMO, which is hard to find these days, what with cross-pollination. GMO contamination has made crops like corn problematic, and the same thing has happened with beets that are grown for sugar, canning and industrial dyes. Cross-pollination is becoming such a problem that even many organic beets grown for fresh eating can be tainted at seed. That's not the greatest reason to stop eating beets for your health, though. The greatest reason is that you can do much better. For example, red pitaya, also called dragon fruit, which you can find in smoothie packs in the frozen food aisle of the grocery store or in pure powdered form, is much more liver healing and blood building than beets can ever be. After all, if you're going out of your way to grow or eat something for a specific reason, wouldn't you want to know what's really the best? Wild blueberries are far more cleansing for the liver than beets, as are asparagus and Brussels sprouts. Even apples have beets beat by a landslide. You don't have to stop eating beets if you like them. Just know you're not eating them for your liver. What organic, non-GMO beets offer are a variety of trace minerals, vitamins, antioxidants, and other phytochemicals, as well as valuable glucose that can be helpful for providing overall energy and healing throughout the whole body. Do beware of GMO beets. They are destructive. At the same time, you've got to be aware of something. All normal cars have four wheels and an engine, and they can at least drive. Still, do you pick any old car? Or do you choose a car with fewer miles, better brakes, working airbags, and the modern conveniences we've come to expect? With the state of cars today, would you buy one that didn't have air conditioning and power windows? Not unless it were the only car available to you, or you were a vintage car collector. And the beat is not the equivalent of a classic. That ultimate classic beauty would be an apple. So if what you're after is liver healing, why not choose the miraculous apple, whose pectin outweighs beets' benefits? And if you're after an enhanced model, if you eat beets for the value of their rich colouring, why not go for the turbocharged pigments of red pitaya or wild blueberries? That beets are red, and your blood is red, and your liver is reddish, that's not a reason all on its own to eat beets for your liver. The miraculous, undiscovered antioxidants in pitaya and wild blueberries win. So do the blood, lymph, and liver-purifying properties of asparagus and Brussels sprouts for true liver cleansing. Nothing can touch them. If you enjoy eating beets that you grow in your garden, don't stop. There are healing benefits to growing beets, plucking them out of the ground, knocking the dirt off them, prepping the roots and the greens and eating them. There's something inherently majestic about it even. With a greater sense of where beets stand in the grand scheme of healing foods, now you're fully informed, just as I'm sure you like to be fully informed when you're on the car lot picking out a car. Ultimately, it's up to you. You only have so many meals left in this life. It's your choice what goes into them. Alkaline water. For quite a few years now, alkaline water has been touted as essential for maintaining health. Some experts claim a pH of 9.5 is most suitable for our needs. Is it? Suitable to what needs? The needs of a man-made digestive theory? The needs of a bottled water industry to keep ahead of competitors? Our mental need to feel like we're doing something for our health? What about the needs of the liver? They're what we always bypass, so let's give the liver its due. What does the liver need? Will a higher and higher pH of ionized water cleanse our livers? No, I'm sorry to say it won't. I'm not totally against highly alkalized water or ionized water in small dosages, because one thing's for certain, the water will most likely be pure and clean. Unless, that is, it's cheap tap water thrown into bottles with natural flavours, MSG, and cheap industrialised vitamins and electrolytes, basically cheap road salt, and a fancy label slapped on for people to select as an after-workout restorative. This isn't an anti-alkaline water monologue, though. The bottlers of many waters do have their hearts in it, or at least did at one point. There are some great, high-quality water filtration systems and ionizers out there, and some great, high-quality bottled water. It's all needed. What this is about is our livers. I've often seen and heard people using their high alkalinity waters with the intention of healing their livers. Truth is, when very, very highly alkaline water enters the stomach, something happens of which medical research and science, medical communities, and the alkaline water industry are unaware. Here's the basis. Nothing liquid is supposed to leave the stomach unless it's been balanced, leveled out, neutralized, taken apart and put together again. It's disassembled, reassembled and reconstructed before it takes its journey into the intestinal tract and down the river of the bloodstream to the liver. As I always say, even hundreds of years from now, we as a society still won't know what happens to food and liquid when they enter our stomach. While we'll pretend we do, we won't know the half of it. Your liver's best friend and first line of defense isn't you, I'm sad to say. Though our livers are our best friends, we are not our liver's best friends. As a human race, we have shown our livers that we call the shots. We eat what we want and do what we want, good or bad, for our bodies. Someday, in each of our lives, we're meant to recognize our liver's needs, trust the organ, and try to become its best friend, even if it doesn't trust us yet. Because the human liver doesn't trust the human mind, not automatically. We've broken the liver's trust for centuries, and we've broken our liver's trust throughout our own lives. We need to earn the liver's respect. What your liver does trust is the stomach. That's its best friend. When highly alkaline water enters the stomach, it must drop everything. Do you remember a time when you had to stop what you were doing and scramble, whether because of a phone call or a sudden deadline, or when you realized you were running late for an appointment or you'd slept through your alarm? That's the position your stomach is in when it has to focus on bringing that highly alkaline water down to the right pH before it can be of any use. We put things in our stomachs that we think are right, and then our stomachs adjust them to what we really need. The stomach must similarly adjust when we drink acidic water. Tap water is pretty acidic, as are some bottled waters that came out of reservoirs, were filtered, and that was it. No matter what the imbalance, even though it's just water, it takes the stomach's energy, reserves, and 7-acid blend, as well as pancreatic strength and enzymes, to change the water's structure and take it to a place where the stomach senses it can be safely dispersed to the rest of the body with the best results. What does this have to do with the liver? For one, if someone drinks a large volume of high pH, ionized, alkalized water at once, chances are that the stomach will have to default on its duty. It can't hold on to that much water for long. Not long enough to straighten out the mess and reorganize it. Same if a large amount of acidic water is consumed at once. The stomach will need to let either type of water out of the floodgates, especially if someone is also dealing with any kind of gut issue. And a gut issue is already a low hydrochloric acid and liver issue to begin with. So as the overflow flows over, the liver is called into action. The liver doesn't blame the stomach for forfeiting. It knows who's responsible. To assist the digestive system, the liver releases a different batch of bile from normal, one not primarily geared to break down fats, and instead made to trap water in the intestines until this special bile has raised acidity or lowered the alkalinity an acceptable amount. It's yet one more of the liver's undiscovered chemical functions. This special variety of bile is made up of minerals, enzymes, and complex hormone blends that the liver has stored inside of it long-term, along with a chemical compound that forms a sticky, mucousy film. It takes liver reserves to produce this bile, and it's a costly slowdown process that doesn't help the liver or the stomach, though it does help you make up for the mistake you just unknowingly made. The extra work also means that your liver won't put energy into cleansing while it devotes its resources to neutralizing the water. None of this means you can't partake in the benefits of highly alkaline water. It doesn't mean it's toxic or bad. If you enjoy and believe in it, then sure, I'm with you. You can play with your ionizer machine and create your alkaline water if you feel it holds true healing powers. Just know that it's not a liver healer or cleanser, and don't consume it in large volumes or use it as your regular drinking water. Use it as a medicine in tiny amounts that won't force the stomach to let go of it before it's ready. Also, learn to balance it with the water that your liver does like and use in higher volumes for cleansing, that with a 7.5 to 8.0 pH. This more neutral pH is perfect for the body and doesn't require extra reserves to process. It won't give your stomach extra work to neutralize or force the liver to employ specially made bile. It will allow your liver to go about its business to keep you well in that moment. When you're throwing down highly alkaline water all the time, it's like tapping your liver on the back and interrupting and distracting it over and over when it's in the middle of an important project. Keep that in mind and choose the moments when you're sure you want to interrupt your liver. Otherwise, stick with neutral water. If you want to be crafty, squeeze some fresh lemon or lime into water with a 7.5 or 8.0 pH. It will be its own ionization process, and the water will become more alkalizing for the body without putting your stomach or liver through anything. It will actually help properly cleanse your liver. With this knowledge under your belt, you're that much closer to earning a place of trust with your liver. Free from unknowingly straining it, your power to heal is now exponentially greater. There's yet one more liver myth that we need to make sure we cover so you get all the knowledge you need. And it's one that I've mentioned more than a few times throughout this audiobook. The high-fat trend. Since that's its own entity, we'll explore it more fully in the next chapter. Chapter 35, The High-Fat Trend. The world has become so anti-sugar and anti-carb that it's become almost impossible to find experts in the field of health and wellness who don't shun fruits and starchy vegetables. How did this come to be? To begin with, a lot of trial and error by healthcare professionals in the search for the best diet. Cutting out processed foods alone didn't seem to get most patients better from a myriad of symptoms and conditions. What to do next? How to feed people and keep them happy while also meeting their caloric needs and helping them heal or at least diminish their symptoms? Professionals couldn't lower protein in the diet because protein is what the entire medical model on planet Earth is based upon. At least it has been since 1933, especially in Western cultures. Protein remains an untouchable topic, an untouchable aspect of our diets. It's ingrained in us that without protein we'll diminish, die, disappear. How we got here. The food industry combined with the government in the early 1930s to indoctrinate children in grammar schools and then higher grades across the country in the Protein Act. It became a law of consciousness that can't be broken, like wearing socks. The world will never stop wearing socks, although some people may stop wearing them with certain outfits to fit a style, or maybe there will be a decade when it's not hip to wear socks. In the end, socks will be back on people's feet. It's who we are. We wear socks. This practice holds its ground in a conventional sense, just as protein holds its ground in a conventional and now alternative medical sense. In the old alternative medicine, protein was never a law. Alternative healers of the earlier days, for example the 1920s, never held up protein as the highest source. They believed in vegetables, fruits, potatoes, other starchy vegetables, nuts and seeds. They didn't pay particular mind to protein because they knew there was more than enough protein in these foods. Conventional medicine, on the other hand, became married to protein when we entered the animal industrial age of processing meat. The meat packing industry worked with the government and made a contractual business decision, then joined forces with the pharmaceutical world and ultimately indoctrinated the entire conventional medical industry in a decision that made sense momentarily and put monetary interest before people's physical interests. These grandfathered contracts still exist in vaults somewhere, not for public display. These were no cute secret cookie recipes. They were decisions made for us without any input from us. No votes allowed, no town meetings, none of our knowledge or say whatsoever in private business deals that still hinder our lives with confusion decades later. By the 1970s, an awareness occurred in the conventional medical world that too much fat was not good. It was an awakening that was actually positive. A glimpse of light where they realized too much fat was bad for the heart. Yet the discovery wasn't executed properly, so the potential for progress fell apart. It turned into a low-fat trend that made no sense. That's because the low-fat diets of the day were actually extremely high in fat. These diets increased portions of animal proteins of all kinds, including meats, while having the illusion of being low-fat because they stayed away from avocado, olives, coconut, oils, nuts, and seeds. These foods were practically banned. Coconut and avocado especially were considered poisonous, and if you were a professional in the medical field who suggested them to a patient, you were seen as grossly irresponsible. Low-fat and fat-free products lined the shelves. They weren't healthy products, mind you. They were just reportedly low-fat and fat-free. People thought they were triumphing by avoiding the lard and sugar of chocolate cake, only they replaced it with animal protein, which was filled with fats. What made these the highest in fat diets ever, without anyone realizing it, was a mistake that was ignored then and is ignored now. They didn't realize that animal protein automatically translates to animal fat. We turn a blind eye to the reality that there's any fat in animal protein, and that was the goal to begin with in the early 1930s. That was the master plan. Focus on protein, ignore the fat content, and it worked. When you grow up with parents and grandparents focused on protein, it's a rule you can't escape. Somehow the word protein takes us over as if we've been bitten by a zombie and now we've become zombies too. So in the early 1970s, everyone started buying their low-fat and no-fat products in the stores, yet eating double or triple their amount of animal protein, which was loaded with fat, essentially doubling or tripling their fat intake, despite shutting out old alternative medicine's healthy fats, such as avocado, coconut, nuts, seeds, and olives. At the same time, they were keeping carbohydrates low and avoiding sugar at all costs, while getting it in another way, through alcohol. In the early 1970s, alcohol use was at an all-time high. People were going through low-carb starvation on their diets, reacting emotionally and needing to get their sugar somehow. It's a similar process to what we go through in today's trendy high-fat, high-protein, low-carb diets. People make sure they don't skip their wine or other alcoholic beverages, or they find themselves binge-eating sugar because the diets leave a gap. The low-fat diets of the 70s were one of the early mistakes with the right idea. They were well-intentioned, realizing that high fat wasn't good for us, and done all wrong, because they forgot to fix one piece of the puzzle, which was that business marriage of the 30s made to convince us that protein was law. So even though observers had the right idea in the 70s, when they realized that people were getting sick and that high dietary fat was causing problems, the execution failed instantly, with no one realizing that the protein law was the reason. Today's diets keep on making these well-intentioned mistakes. It's a little different now, which is what we're going to explore next. Today's hybrid diets. There's a myriad of diet programs and food belief systems out there that have been renamed over and over again to repackage the same concept. A high-protein, low-carb diet. With a new name, for example, calling it an autoimmune diet, it seems like it's a different twist. It's not. It's just another anti-carb, anti-sugar, extremely high-fat eating plan, even if it incorporates lean proteins. Lately, some repackaged diets are proud to say that they are high in fat, as if high fat is good for you. These are just slightly upgraded versions of the original high-protein diets of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Today's high-protein diets have more greens thrown in, more green juices. Many allow a green apple or some healthy berries in the door. They advocate eating a lot of salad and other vegetables. People suffered more from the early low-carb, high-protein, low-fat diets because they didn't get these healing foods that they needed. As medical communities observed patients coming off standard diets, they observed many symptoms subsiding. "Eureka! We've struck gold," physicians who were interested in foods said along the way. Sometimes long-term symptoms would fade, sometimes short-term ones too, and even though some patients would experience no benefits at all and others, health would worsen over time, it felt like barriers were breaking down in the world of medicine. Because conventional medicine was finally paying attention. Up until this point, conventional medicine hadn't generally oriented itself around diets and food. Not much was known about them. For the most part, the conventional medical world believed that diet had nothing to do with disease or healing, with the exception of too much red meat not being good for the heart. Now offshoots of conventional medicine were forming where doctors wanted to know more, learn more, get their hands in food more. They wanted more out of food because they knew from their own experiences or watching others' experiences or hearing about alternative doctors' experiences that medical school wasn't teaching enough about healing foods. So they ventured past the usual strictures into alternative, holistic ways. Ways that alternative doctors and herbalists had been balked at, laughed at, humiliated, discredited, or put in prison for teaching for years. Hundreds of alternative doctors in the US alone were put in prison or their careers were destroyed through the 20th century, guilty only of doing something different. Today, people take their advancements for granted as they freely and easily express personal views in alternative health. They don't realize where those rights came from or what had to occur in the past to be able to speak out in the present. As we moved into the 2000s, medical professionals who had been brought up in conventional medicine and now finally saw what alternative medicine had to offer were creating hybrid medical models. Alternative medicine wasn't the lone wolf or the black sheep anymore. Now, conventional medical professionals were blending the alternative wisdom of, for example, leafy greens and green juices into their conventional diets of less processed foods and leaner proteins. They became the functional medicine and holistic and alternative medical doctors of our time. At certain points along the way, they did start to realize there were limits. Turned out, outlawing bread and grains didn't solve life's mysteries or erase chronic illness. And too much meat and chicken and other animal protein in the diet weren't giving the results they needed. So they started to hybridize even more and bring in avocados and coconuts, once considered dangerously fattening, and high-quality nut and seed butters, which they themselves had similarly poo-pooed and shunned before. Today's popular diets are hybrid high-protein diets, high-in-quality lean protein, plant fat, leafy greens, green juices and veggies, and incorporating just a handful of fruit. It's all formed by trial and error, mistakes made in the past, and stealing the hard-earned gems of success from the alternative health world. Healers have been ridiculed along the way for offering more sensible diets, bits and pieces of which are making their way into the mainstream today. No one knows this history, and you need to know it for any sort of perspective. Is this better than the processed food diets of the past? Yes. Is it giving people relief from their symptoms? Many people, yes. Is it curing chronic illness? No. Is there a special name for every new version of this hybrid diet? Yes. Are they all, underneath the names, the same? Pretty much. Although these diets may be a little different here and there, it's the same model, the same core. They are, no doubt, better than their old no-carb, high-protein, high-fat predecessor diets, and they do help people steer clear of junk food and fried food and cakes and cookies and most processed foods when patients are committed. A patient will most likely see some results in overall inflammation. What we need to remember about that is that the medical model doesn't know why inflammation occurs in the first place, or why it reduces on a given diet. The theory is that the inflammation is autoimmune, arising from the body attacking tissue, or they believe that a certain food itself is directly causing the inflammation, or that the food is triggering an autoimmune response in the body. It's still nothing like what it could be. For real healing food inspiration, doctors need to look back to the herbalists and naturopaths and holistic doctors who were getting results for patients long before the hybrid high-fat diets of today. These were physicians and other practitioners of the 1960s, 70s and 80s, and even going back 100 or more years who didn't have better technology, just better dietary sense, who were shunned and disgraced by the medical world and government for advising patients to focus on plant foods. Alternative communities were mostly plant-based in the old days, though they had to be careful, because practitioners could lose their livelihoods if word got out that they were advising patients likewise. Back in the 1800s, meat bars were the fast food establishments of the day, where you could go to drink ale and sink your teeth into a huge portion of meat. Alternative-minded doctors observed that these meals weren't good for the bowels or the heart, and that fueled their advice to lower animal sources and bring in more plant foods. As food became industrialized, the alternative-minded also observed that boxed and canned food wasn't great. They knew they already had the ticket to alleviating ailments, many of which, whether they realized it or not, related back to the liver. Sugar, carbs, protein, and hidden fat. What has stayed a constant since the supposedly low-fat and really high-fat diets of the 1970s is that when a diet goes high-fat, what many call high-protein, not realizing it automatically means high-fat, it goes no-carb or low-carb too. You'll hear that it's because the sugar that carbohydrates break down into and sugar itself cause problems, in part by turning into fat. When low-quality carbs in a diet go up, doctors observe that patients' health declines and they don't know why, though it's easy to blame the carbs. What no one realizes is that the problem is the combination of sugar with fat. Together, they clash. Accidentally, people realized that eating chocolate mousse after a steak dinner might not be the best choice, so they kept the steak dinner and skipped the mousse with no idea that this isn't really a solution. They ended up attacking all forms of carbs and sugar. Since doctors think sugar is the problem, they take the sugar out of the diet and keep the fat. And it's true. A1C levels can drop. Prediabetes can disappear. And diabetes can improve if someone's also exercising. No one knows the real reason why lowering carbohydrate intake makes a difference, though. They think it's because sugar is inherently problematic or plays tricks on the body. It's led to blaming the wrong culprit. Removing healthy sugar is not the answer. Reducing radical fat, that's where the answer lies for truly long-term healing, especially healing a chronic illness. Fat and sugar. Here in the US and around the globe, the combination is everywhere. Sweet barbecue sauce on fatty ribs with buttered corn on the cob. Ketchup on hash browns. Pizza with sweet tomato sauce, a wheat crust, and fatty, oily cheese that's also filled with lactose, dairy sugar. Pork with rice, fried chicken and mashed potatoes, cheese and crackers, grilled cheese dripping with butter, bread and butter. A common sandwich, that is, bread with any kind of meat because it combines the carbs of the bread, which break down into sugar, and the fat of the meat. And then add the works, and you've got a meal like a tuna sandwich, fat and sugar, with mayonnaise, fat, a bag of chips, fat and sugar, and a soda, sugar. It's what we've done all along, and it doesn't work for many health reasons. Some that are known, and some that are completely unknown by medical research and science. If you skipped over chapter 15, diabetes and blood sugar imbalance, you may want to go back and listen to the more in-depth information there. What about protein? Doesn't the protein in the meals we've mentioned overshadow everything else, since protein is king? And people on trendy diets often incorporate lean protein. So what's the problem? Here's the catch with protein. It comes with plenty of fat. It's how people on high-protein, no-carb diets survive. They're getting fat calories, whether they know it or not. Doctors in the older days knew that meat contained fat. For some reason, that's become a forgotten, hidden truth of medicine, so we need to be the ones who remember and see. People feared nuts and coconut because they knew they contained fat. Now they're accepted more because fat is more accepted. People opt for chicken without knowing that chicken has more fat than nuts or coconuts could ever have. We pretend that chicken breast has no fat and is just a protein source. If you were to take out fat from protein sources, people on high-protein, no-carb diets would literally starve to death. Though at least they'd die thinking they were getting enough protein. Chapter 38, Liver Rescue 369, will cover protein more. As you heard about in Chapter 2, your adaptogenic liver, we never really know how much fat is in a given food. There's so much hidden fat even in what we think is lean. The nutrition labels we read are averages and estimates, because think about it. Do you have the same body fat ratio as your neighbours? As everyone in your family? No, you're all different. The same goes for chickens in the coop, and cows in the field, and fish in the hatchery, and game in the wild. They're individuals with different bodies, and each farm feeds the domesticated ones differently. So the grams of fat per serving are going to vary wildly. Same with nuts and seeds and other plant proteins. Each tree or plant is going to be different. Since food companies need to standardize labeling, though, they can't separately test, measure, and weigh the fat content of every chicken's body and every walnut before they package it. We can never be sure how much fat we're truly consuming. It's frequently much more than we realize, so we're getting a lot more fat than we know. What we see on the label is not accurate. It can't be. There are diets out there that say they're low fat for the liver, and they still have hidden fat in them because they incorporate, for example, lots of chicken breast. That's not what the liver really wants. Losing longevity. On a high-fat, strictly low to no-carb diet, even most committed people will eventually break and binge to meet their sugar needs. What are sugar needs? Well, you know about blood sugar. It's what sustains us and keeps us alive, glucose. Beyond that, storage bins of glycogen keep your brain from atrophying, keep your liver strong, and keep other vital parts of your body going to keep you alive. On a high-fat, low-carb diet, the heart slowly becomes weary. It yearns for the person to eat the berries the diet permits them, because it desperately needs and wants even the very little sugar they contain. While it won't really be adequate, it will just be enough to keep the heart going, because the heart is a muscle that needs that glucose for survival. At the same time, the heart struggles to pump blood through the body because of its high fat content. The brain and liver monitor their glycogen storage, and when it starts to get low, their messages lead a person on a low-carb diet to binge and eat two slices of pizza at a friend's house, a bag of chips out at lunch, a candy bar from a hotel minibar, or a piece of organic chocolate, calling out at the natural foods store. If you change the approach and bring in high-quality glucose from fruits and starchy vegetables, remember your three C's, critical clean carbohydrates from chapter 13, while lowering fat so the natural sugar can do its job, the brain and liver are no longer forced to sound the emergency sirens that lead you to grab the nearest dairy or coconut ice cream cone. When you are eating radical fats, some of the best foods to eat with them are vegetables, leafy greens, lemons, limes, oranges, tomatoes, celery, cucumbers, and red bell peppers. A little bit of sweet fruit can be okay with fat. For example, if you want some mango on a salad with avocado, that's not the end of the world. An avocado-banana smoothie, on the other hand, isn't ideal unless that's formula for a child. A great way to separate fats and sugars in your day is to snack on fruit with some leafy greens, cucumber slices, or celery sticks if you want, about 20 minutes before you eat a meal with radical fats. That gives the glucose time to disperse while filling you up, so you don't need such large portions of radical fats. If you're looking for more guidance, when you can, consider avoiding the combination of radical fats with healthy carbohydrates such as potatoes, gluten-free grains or beans, or unhealthy carbohydrates such as table sugar. It's also helpful to avoid adding more fats to animal proteins. Cooking animal proteins with oil, deep frying them or adding butter or an egg on top compounds the fats, which gives your liver more work. If you keep carbs out for too long, your life can be shortened. I don't enjoy breaking this news. It's no fun, and it angers the high-fat, low-carb monarchy. It's like walking up to a beehive and rattling the branch. The bees become angry and start to sting. Rulers in the high-fat belief system, who believe that high fat helps you live longer, get extra angry. When people's life's work and resources are invested in a concept, the last thing they want is to be told they're wrong. It would be almost impossible to change course when they've dedicated everything they have to their endeavour. They also get angry because it's very possible that their livers are inundated with toxins and fats. They could have emotional, sluggish, cranky, and angry livers. Low carb is not a longevity diet. It's a short-jevity diet. This is part of why the hip, trending diets have been altered lately to bring in a little more carbohydrate to go along with the high fat and protein. Avocado, for example, has some natural sugar in it, not just fat, and that fructose is just enough to keep your heart from becoming injured or dying on a low-carb diet. Does the expert behind a diet know specifically that the sugar in the avocado is why people do better incorporating it into their meals? I doubt it. Regardless, they're bringing in avocados while also allowing a little more leeway for seeds and nut butters, which contain some natural sugars too, and life-sustaining carbohydrates such as berries and apples, however sparingly. Somewhere inside, experts know that an all-animal protein diet with no carbs is not good for the long haul. So they reduce the animal proteins in trendy diets to some degree to make room for other fats, accidentally finding some more results. Trial and error with low-carb, high-protein, high-fat diets of the past left a wake of sickness, remorse, and unproductive results. As each decade goes by, more and more mistakes get forgotten, and they're never really corrected or documented for all to learn from them. Instead of making progress by learning from the past, we're making random, accidental spurts of progress by stumbling in the dark until we finally get to a door that opens. It doesn't offer a foundation to explain why people are sick or why someone gets the results they do. Fear of fruit. With hybrid diets, we're at a point in history when our best experts are the closest they've been in a long time to crafting food plans that make sense for our health. These diets still aren't anywhere to hang our hats. While it's great that people are cleaning up their diets overall of processed grains and other processed foods, junk food and fast food, and because of this starting to see improvements in some areas of their health, there's a limit. It's not the be-all, end-all. It's not the whole answer. In most cases of autoimmune and other viral-related illnesses, that is, hundreds of the most common chronic illnesses that plague the population today, these diets aren't enough to make the real healing happen. Protein smoothies with nut butter and coconut oil for breakfast are better than bacon and eggs with hash browns. They're still not the best. I know the argument for these trendy diets is that they seem to help children with autism or assist people with losing weight. It's true that some children, some people, see a difference in the moment. It doesn't mean the diets are healing anything at a base level. They may keep symptoms at bay and bring slight improvements. And yes, this is beneficial, and it matters. Any improvement counts. Still, we need to be aware of why we're getting any improvements at all, and then of how to get even more improvements. Because the last thing you want is for your improvements to slip through your fingers, like sand, disappearing without your ever knowing why. You need to know more. I've seen hundreds of people do high-fat and stay the same with their symptoms and conditions or even worsen. The ones who do get some results at first end up worsening later. That said, these diets are a lot better than so much of what's out there, especially for someone who's not really sick, just experiencing a little symptom here or there. If someone just needs to lose a little weight and get the sniffles to improve, a trendy diet of today could get the weight to drop, clear the head a little, improve some focus and concentration, allow for more energy, reduce inflammation, and pick things up overall for many. And yet, even with experts convinced there's nothing better than a high-fat diet, I'm here to tell you that there's much better out there for you. One of the biggest drawbacks to these trendy diets is that they shun fruit. That's because over the last decade or so, certain professionals in the field of medicine have put out information about certain foods that's false and misleading, and it spreads like poison ivy. It was a grave mistake for them to associate fruit with bad carbs. Consult the Fruit Fear chapter in Medical Medium. Short version, if you ever hear the expression sugar is sugar, don't believe it. Fruit sugar is in a class of its own and should never be mistaken for a troublemaker. With today's popular diets, if you're a kid suffering from any type of gut or cognitive issue, fruit will be taken away based on the false theory that the brain is made out of fat. The truth is that it's made out of glycogen, carbohydrate storage of glucose, solidified into highly active, electrically sustainable soft tissue with small traces of omega-3s in and around it. The majority of the brain is carbohydrate. When fruit is taken away on these diets, fat becomes the main calorie source, and that can hurt and even kill your liver over time. It may not hurt your liver as badly as if you were living on fast food. Still, it could slow your liver down, make it more dysfunctional, and allow for the possibility of all the diseases and symptoms in this audiobook. It's true, even if you're an exercise instructor who works out all the time, or you take walks religiously and you're thin with low body fat percentage, your liver can be stressed from a high-fat diet. These trendy diets, regardless, will lead you to a fatty liver, even if it takes 30 years. When you eat a lot of fat, the liver grows fat. If high fats in the diet are mostly from avocado, coconut, and nut butters, and you're getting some natural sugars, that will at least allow for some improvement. Don't let fruit scare you. There's misinformation out there that says eating sugar leads to a fatty liver and that eating fruit hurts the liver. It keeps people away from fruit, and that's misleading, deceiving, and devastating. It keeps them away from their true potential longevity. A false summit. Look, if you're on one of these high-fat, low-carb diets, you don't need to panic. It's better than fried food every night with a big chocolate cake afterward. At the same time, your liver wants more of what it needs, and it doesn't want to get fatty. What the experts who create pop theory lifestyle diets don't know is that your liver runs on glucose and stored glycogen to give you a healthy, long life, protecting your adrenals, heart, and brain. I know the image of ancient man foraging in the woods, eating only a handful of berries and killing whatever he needed to survive. Times have changed. We have food that we can pick and choose now. We can pick and choose the outcome of our health because we have options. And for what it's worth, whatever belief system you may hold, ancient humans ate very little to begin with, and many times starved from going weeks on nothing more than a few mushrooms and some dirt. They ate wild game only as a survival tactic, if it was even available in times of starvation. What ancient humans ate the most of were starchy tubers, rhizomes, shoots, and nuts, because those were most accessible. When they could, essentially, they ate high-carb diets. Since we think fat's the way to health, and it's there at our fingertips, and we're not ancient man going from moment to moment of near starvation, we can decide to feed ourselves fat without a break. Since we're not being educated about how important healthy carbohydrates are for our health, we go through glucose deprivation and eat even more fats because we think that will satisfy us. It's the trend of the day. The label science can be used to put a spin on everything possible in conventional and alternative health. As long as that word is used, anything good can be spun to seem bad, and anything bad can be spun to seem good. Keep this in mind. And if you're concerned about what you're hearing here, please refer to A Note for You at the beginning of this audiobook and listen to it over and over again. For the record, this chapter is not an attack on animal protein. It's when animal protein defines a diet that we need to take care and evaluate if that's best for that individual. All the popular diets include too much fat, vegan and vegetarian included. Vegans eat too many avocados, nuts, seeds, coconut, tofu, and oil. Vegetarians eat too much butter, cheese, eggs, and milk. This applies even if it's from a cow in the backyard that you've milked yourself. Vegans and vegetarians alike indulge in bad carbs with bad fats. Greasy foods like cheap falafel fried in cheap corn oil and French fries made in canola oil. Vegetarians enjoy baguettes with brie and grilled cheese sandwiches. With high-fat diets, whether they include carbs or not, whether they include animal products or not, things can go wrong with our health. I'm not here to pick a side in the food wars. My battle is to bring to light medical information that's from an independent source and undiscovered by research and science so you can protect yourself and your family. My job is to see through the fog and hear through the noise in the medical industry. It's not about picking one aisle or another in the food world. It's not about vegan versus paleo versus any new food belief system in between. It's about giving you the right information so you can make proper choices to heal. The healthier vegan and vegetarian diets of today don't look all that different from the healthier diets that focus on animal proteins. The plant-based ones tend to lower carbs and incorporate gluten-free grains with fewer fried options. Better, higher quality oil, higher quality butter, more greens and other veggies, and more coconut, hemp seeds, sunflower seeds, and avocado. The animal protein-focused ones often stay very low carb and bring in lots of chicken, pasture-raised meat, eggs, and fish, as well as some avocado, nut butter, coconut oil, greens, and other veggies. Both versions stay high-fat and stick to low-sugar fruits. Through the hybridization of alternative and conventional medicine over the past 20 years, the different diets have grown together. As we saw in the beginning of the chapter, high-fat from standard conventional diets merged with greens and juices from past rivals and enemies, and we ended up with what you see on health shows, in other books, and in the latest articles. It's considered the best that it gets, the answer to all our problems, the pinnacle. Well, don't do your happy dance just yet. It's a false summit. Seeing clearly. Without knowing how we got here, we become prey to mistakes still happening that we cannot see. The system that's developing may or may not work in our favour. We can't tell if we turn a blind eye. That's why, here, we've needed to look back and understand how the high-fat trend came to be. You know how in life, You don't want to go into a meeting without being informed about why it's happening. How you don't want to eat a meal placed before you if you don't know anything about it. Somehow a trend is all we need to feel like we've been fully informed. If others are filing into the meeting room, we'll follow. If there's hype, we'll eat the mystery meal. It's how we've arrived at this place where nearly everyone is on a high-fat diet. One has a little more meat. One has a lot less meat. One has fat 3 times a day. One has avocado and coconut sometimes. One only allows a handful of berries for carbs. One is focused on bacon and eggs. One brings in more green juices. One is focused on butter in everything. One says it's designed around your genes. A new diet is born every day. And then there are the people who like to decide for themselves what to eat, not follow a plan, and yet end up falling into the high-fat trap too, even if they allow themselves more food groups. Whether we're conscious of their influence or not, ideologies and belief systems are what always stop or slow down progress in the medical world of chronic illness. And when it comes to food, that's one way to truly slow down results. One reason why alternative medicine was shunned and discredited for so long was because it did the opposite. It offered ways to slow down illness and disease that the conventional medical industry benefited from financially. For decades before today's trendy diets, people, whether they ate animal protein, kept vegan or vegetarian, or did anything in between, benefited from the healing foods that they ate. No matter the food mythologies that come and go, healing foods always have been and always will be fruits, vegetables, leafy greens, nuts, seeds, herbs, and spices. They're like the originators of rock and roll. Newsflash. Rock music's origin story did not begin with mega-hit British bands. It began as a birthright of African Americans' rich musical heritage that was then adopted by people from all walks of life. Conventional medicine now benefits from the alternative health field that was ostracized for so long, and in some respects, still is. From afar, conventional medicine watched as people saw differences result from consuming fresh fruits and juices and leafy greens. Shots of wheatgrass juice, large salads with kale, sprouts and pea shoots, and even bananas. And then, when the mainstream hybrid experts were starting on their paths, they decided to pick and choose what would fit into their high-fat belief systems. Whatever they incorporated had to fit into a diet of largely animal protein, since that law of survival from the 1930s was still firmly institutionalized. Carbohydrates took the hit, which when it comes to the bad carbs, like breads and donuts and cookies and cakes and pastries and flours and other processed grains, has helped. Eliminating those was an accomplishment the medical world could have hung its hat on.